Más hermosa que el lindo el azul del cielo de mi fuga primorosa.
Santiago, oye mi son. Santiago, oye mi son.
Qué bellas son las palmeras del oriente legendario. Este temerario enarboló con destreza, combatiendo al enemigo, el ejemplo que nos diera el mundo ha reconocido.
Santiago era hoy en mi sur.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview recorded November 4th with Jack Womack. And, of course, a review from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
Thank you. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The title for the new Chinese film Sword Master makes it sound like the most generic wuxia epic ever. And in some ways it is. You get all the expected beats, warring houses, a stoic loner who has forsworn killing, a love triangle. This may be due to the fact that this is actually a remake of the classic 1977 film Death Duel. But it's also an oversimplification. The producer here is Joy Hark, who doesn't do anything in a small way, as such films as Peking Opera Blues and Detective D: Mystery of the Phantom Flame demonstrate. And under the direction of Derek Yee, who was originally the star of Death Duel, the film, which was originally shot for 3D but isn't being exhibited that way here, can barely contain itself to the screen. That's something of a problem if you're looking for a finely honed narrative. There's almost too much to Swordmaster, what with clan clashes, numerous flashbacks, a mysterious quote-unquote third master with whom the reformed assassin Yen, played by Peter Ho, has a date with destiny, a seemingly invulnerable brothel janitor played by Lin Gengjin, who may not be all he seems, at least one and possibly two betrayed lovers, the introduction of a band of humble outhouse cleaners. I think that's their job, I'm not sure. All I know is they wander through a village proclaiming how stinky their buckets of excrement are. A magic pill that exists solely to keep a key character from exiting the film too soon, and on and on. I spent at least the first half of the film going, who are these people, and how do they relate to what I've seen already? Turns out things make a kind of sense eventually, but I did feel like it would be helpful to have one of those walls they have in conspiracy thrillers, where photographs of people are connected by colored threads, just to clear things up. But in the end, it's not all that important overall. This is a film about spectacle and exquisite martial arts action, choreographed by Yuan Bin and Dion Lin, and Swordmaster delivers on all fronts with that kind of burnished, movie reality look that Chinese films do so well, digital effects that make a virtue of their artificiality, charismatic performances by both Ho and Gengjin, and tons of battle scenes that never seem to repeat their beats. Swordmaster may tread some well-worn paths and deliver too much in the process, but too much here is gorgeous, and I downright loved it. In contrast, independent filmmaker Sofia Takal has been making a name for herself with small, semi-improvised dramas that occasionally take turns to the dark. In her latest, Always Shine, two friends, both actresses, played by Mackenzie Davis and Caitlin Fitzgerald, take a trip to Big Sur in an attempt to repair a friendship recently put at jeopardy as one woman's career has leapfrogged over the other's. It does not go well, with severe consequences, and Takal brings a unique, feminine perspective to the conflict, which, interestingly, was written by Takal's partner, Michael Lawrence Levine, who also appears in the film. There is a serious kink here. Takal has decided to lord the film with fast-cut, semi-subliminal flash-forwards. It feels like a self-conscious attempt to telegraph the darkening ambience. At best, it takes me out of the narrative. At worst, it's downright confusing. Always Shine's relationships are compelling enough and the repercussions intriguing enough that it didn't really need such tricks of the cutting room. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And thank you, Dan. So, before we get on to the main body of the show, let me tell you that, yes, this is pre-recorded, although only a few hours before it's actually being broadcast, but I'll actually get some sleep and other work done tonight as a result. And most of the show will be pre-recorded. The interview with Jack is about an hour 15 minutes long, but I must promote next Monday's reading. It's next Tuesday's reading, but it's being held on Monday. So if you show up on Tuesday, bring a TARDIS. Outside of that, Monday, December 12th at 7 p.m., at 388 Atlantic Avenue, the Brooklyn Common, same building as WBAI, our annual holiday reading event. It occurred to me sometime back that there has always been a tradition that you see families in December. You watch, you know, the news signing off, and there's like the entire staff, or somebody brings out their kids and stuff like that. And so we decided many years ago to have a family. And in fact, it's the same family each and every year, because we love them and they are a dynamic duo in writing. They are Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. And this is a favorite event. It's always well attended and will be even more well attended. That's not English, but whatever it is. It will be even better attended this year because you're going to show up, right? Okay. So Delia Sherman writes stories and novels for younger readers and adults. Her short stories have appeared in numerous anthologies and magazines and in the small beer press collection Young Woman in a Garden. Her most recent novels for younger readers are The Freedom Maze, which won the 2012 Myth of Poetic and Andre Norton Awards, and The Evil Wizard Smallbone. She has worked as contributing editor for Tor Books, co-edited several anthologies. She is a frequent instructor in the children's literature program at Hollins University, as well as Clarion and Odyssey science fiction writing workshops. Next to writing, her favorite occupations are traveling, cooking, and knitting, probably in that order. She shares a rambling apartment in New York City with wife Ellen Kushner, numerous books, and far too many pieces of paper. And her website is at DeliaSherman.com. Ellen Kushner's first novel, complete with the airplane, the cult classic Swords Point, introduced readers to Riverside, the setting she later returned to in The Privilege of the Sword, The Fall of the Kings, co-written with Delia Sherman, and a collection of related short stories. Kushner recorded all three novels in audiobook form for Neil Gaiman Presents from Audible.com, which won the 2012 Audie Award for Swords Point. A new online collaborative prequel to Swords Point called Tremontaine began, about a year ago, but season two premiered this October. By the way, the Serial Point people will be doing the Nursef reading in May, so bear that in mind. With Holly Black, Kushner co-edited Welcome to Bordertown. I'm a big fan of Bordertown. A revival of the original urban fantasy shared world series created by Terry Windling. She's also written the World Fantasy Award-winning Thomas the Rhymer, and back in the day was responsible for five of the Choose Your Own. Oh, God, she does a lot of stuff, folks. She wrote The Golden Dreidel, which was adapted into the Klezmer Nutcracker for New York's Vital Theater, co-founder of the Interstitial Arts Foundation. She was at NPR for years, doing a great show called Sound and Spirit. She's had radio drama on WBAI, in fact. Just show up Tuesday, this coming, no, Monday. It's so automatic. I still sometimes try to introduce this program as being on Saturday mornings. Monday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. You will get glared at if you don't contribute. Well, not glared at. We are actually very understanding. But donations are really necessary because, we pay rent. And it costs money to do this and stuff like that there. So hope to see you then. Our guest this morning, recorded November 4th, is an Hour of the Wolf regular, Jack Womack. I have known him for well over 30 years before his first novel came out, Ambient. I have lots of stories to tell. Suffice it to say that by a total coincidence, he and I were once working in the same independent bookstore, and Samuel R. Delaney walked in and was telling me, "This is a book you've got to read." And of course, Jack was within earshot of this because Chip didn't know that Jack worked there. Oh, yeah, Chip's reading for us in April. Anyway, it's a very small world. Womack's science fiction is brilliant. It's hard to describe, and William Gibson has tried to describe it. They're close friends, but don't even bother. But with titles like Let's Put the Future Behind Us, you can tell that there's interesting stuff. We're talking about his first new book in years, and I'm not even going to mention it because you're going to be hearing so much, starting with him reading from it.
The flying discs, as I knew them. One summer day in 1964, I turned on Lexington's local TV morning show. The hostess dressed in a style one part Derby Party, one part Christmas Cracker. The host flashed the shins of an albino Rockette each time he crossed his legs. Rather than horses that morning, they raved about a new paperback, Frank Edwards' Strange World. As I write this, I am looking at the very copy of Strange World my grandmother bought me an hour later, plucked from the black metal paperback rack at Rexall Drugs on East High Street. It is entry number one in the library I went on to build over 40 years, long called Human, All Too Human. I read the book twice that afternoon, believing the unbelievable. The Monster Apes of Oregon, the Loch Ness Monster, the Barbados Coffins, Poltergeists, the Man They Couldn't Hang, Plagues of Mold, Glowing Purple Blobs in the Middle of 26th Street in Philadelphia, and as per the back blurb, Who... or what, painted Remember Pearl Harbor on an Indiana sidewalk 2 years before the infamous attack. And throughout the text, accounts of flying saucers. This was Edwards' last compilation of outre tales prior to flying saucers' serious business, or rather UFOs, the au courant term by the 1960s. To a mid-century child with curious mind yet no interest in science fiction writing, even the implications of a purple blob at a street somewhere in Philadelphia stirred thoughts of UFOs, their origins, their pilots, their languages. If proven, there were possibilities there. Flying saucers inspired in me that same sense of wonder about which my friends in science fiction speak. Both were ways to see beyond the neighborhood. The literature of the flying saucer. Outer space contains planets, stars, wonders. Venus, Mars, Clarion, Vulcan, crosses on the moon, thunderstones. But inner space? Conspiracy theories, the true meaning of lights in the sky, spiritual messages, government distrust, the escapades of dark-suited men, inferior races, eugenics, the cosmic Jew, fantasies fascist or murderous, sexual imaginings, confessions of lonely souls, and choate attempts to understand one's perfect personal visions, spectacularly pointless hoaxes, folk myth, psychological insights, poetry, the perfect lunacy of holy fools. The literature of the flying saucer is the literature of the alien most familiar to us.
Today's date is Friday, November 4th. In the afternoon, in Morningside Heights, and you just heard Jack Womack reading from his new book. It's overdue that I am able to say it's a new book. Flying Saucers Are, that's an underscore, are real, which some people no doubt always knew and will be very disappointed to find out how real they are, or aren't, perhaps. It's quite an industry, isn't it?
It certainly has been, at least during the last 50 years of the 20th century.
Yeah.
I mean, from the moment the first ones were seen in 1947 and quickly became, you know, picked up by the newspapers. And so they were seen on Friday, and then by Sunday, the term flying saucers had already been coined and the story had gone around the world at that point. It was a very early example of viral media.
Yeah.
It was just done in the, you know, from one reporter, from one radio reporter to the other around the world. It would then be picked up by the press, and then those would be issued, and the press would copy from other newspapers. And before you knew it, the story passed around. Even that's as effectively as, you know, just within, say, 10 years ago. I mean,
even more recent. Art Bell, his Coast to Coast radio show, is a nightly, you know, after Long John Neville had so much fun with it.
Oh, Long John Neville had a wonderful time with it from the recordings I've heard.
Oh, yeah, so. Two of his regular guests were Lester Del Rey and Frederick Pohl. To guffaw, especially Lester,
right?
You know, he would chide. He wouldn't guffaw. He would chide.
Right.
Long John and
For even having on the nuts.
I don't think one of them put any credence into anything, but it made great radio.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, completely. I think Jackie Gleason was on a couple of times, too.
Was he? Really?
I think he was. Like, he was actually, he was of the school that didn't believe in contactees. So he would be brought on to say, so when you met Gord from the planet Venus, what did he explain to you about the atmosphere?
Yes.
Well, I mean, he would actually ask really sensible questions from a skeptical point of view.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, I mean, he built his house in the shape of a flying saucer upstate. Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
Yes, because he was a huge UFO believer, had a huge, big library at the time. I'd love to see what was in that. His house somewhere in upstate New York. It's like between here and Albany.
For some reason, I always feel in my head, I think of him as being in Florida.
Well, that's the show was filmed out of Miami because they just would take the train down
Westinghouse Network?
No, it was on CBS. It may have started on the Westinghouse Network, but it was on CBS till, you know, it went off the air in the mid-60s.
Yeah, Westinghouse, which became Metromedia.
Right.
Part of Channel 5 would have been
Which eventually in New York. The great channel that showed karate movies every Saturday.
Yes, exactly.
The one great purpose it served. Yes.
Was there another? I think they had a great children's show that I may have watched.
Yeah, and Channel 9 had Million Dollar Matinee.
So Million Dollar Movie.
Dollar Movie.
Yes, with the theme for Gone with the Wind.
Yep.
First time I saw Gone with the Wind, I said they got that from Channel 9.
And then they just, like, on Thanksgiving, you'd always count on watching the Macy's Parade and then watching the giant gorillas.
Absolutely.
So it was all three I have, and sometimes I do that. I'll throw in all three just on Thanksgiving while cooking's going on, just to get that real nostalgic feeling.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so I got interested in flying saucers when I was 8 years old. And just...
And where were you living?
I was living in Lexington, back in Kentucky, where I grew up. And... you know, I went to, the Rexall was in walking distance of my grandmother's house, so I'd walk around the corner. It was a little shopping, you know, it was a little 20 shoppy area that had been, it was still in great shape in the 60s. Had a movie theater and a couple, and a 5 and 10 cent store that had wooden floors and trays with the toys in them.
Oh, I love those. I live for those stores.
And there's an indie meat marketplace, and then there's Rexall's. And that's where every week there'd be new comics and new paperback books. And
I assume a soda fountain.
There was initially. It was gone by the late 60s.
Oh.
I used to go to my mother worked in a building, the Dunn Building, which housed Dunn Drugs. And they were old school. And they had a soda fountain that I used to eat at all the time. Every time I'd visit her at her office, that's where I'd go have lunch. Usually your basic cheese sandwich sliced diagonally, so or something else from like so not exact not as old as old timey in its own way as the Ratner's menu in the kitchen, but just more like fried bologna sandwiches and that sort of thing.
Fried bologna, wow! I have fried salami. I've never tried to fry bologna.
It works. You need to cut. It's like with Taylor ham. You need to cut through the. Each end, four quarters.
Yeah.
You know, and that way it won't curl up, you know, as it's cooking.
Right.
So, Anyway, what? How did we get into cooking again? Anyway,
what did you? What did you? What
from the? It's, that's true. This book has multiple aspects to it. It has nostalgia, as many people have said. Peter Straub told me that he just loved, you know, it brought back such memories. Michael Dirda said the same in his review.
Yeah, he did a wonderful review in the Washington Post.
That was a startlingly good review.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be doing a show. The show is moving down there and moving there sometime next year. And they'll have another show like they had
great.
In August.
So describe the show.
The show is just like covers of the actual books in many cases of hanging from the walls of just the various Flying Saucer books from the collection. Just, you know, I Rode a Flying Saucer or Flying Saucers on the Moon. Or
mm-hmm.
just all, usually, all, mostly all the ones from the 50s and early 60s, which was, of course, the classic period for UFO illustrations.
Yeah.
And there were some blow-ups of those, notably those sexy saucer people, which everyone wanted, seemed to want to have their photo taken in front of. Can't imagine why.
Okay.
And but also just have them out and then...
saucer selfies sounds like a...
There were lots of people who looked like they had come off of flying saucers. If, you know, George Adamski would have been able to have written three more books if he'd seen some of the characters that showed up. But, you know, it was very successful and, you know, it had my name in the window and just the exhibit. And that was pleasing in a very unexpected way. But what I've really gotten the best is just like I have yet to get a bad review. Even Nature, which had some dubious things to say about the format, still gave it a very long, quotable, you know, blurb basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I got Dirda's and everything, but then they gave me to do publicity associated with it. Paris Review had me write an article on flying saucer cover art of the 50s,
ooh,
which is wonderful. So I've made like Paris Review finally. I just like you know, I had to get the flying saucer out. Just so that was very gratifying.
Who knew that's what it took to get on the flying saucer
exactly,
beat.
Exactly. So I've been doing this, and this has been a long time background interest, you know, of mine. People would always say, "Don't you read science fiction? Don't you?" And I'd say, "Well, I watch the movies, but don't you read it? Don't you read it?" I said, "No," but at the time, this had a somewhat shadier association than science fiction did in the 60s.
Yeah.
Because in the 50s, it probably either one would get the same remarks. And it's amazing the overlap between a lot of science fiction covers of the period and the flying saucer books of the period. In you know, there's the one which I call the greatest book on flying saucers ever, on a non-flying saucer book. The flying saucers are real.
Yes.
Which is one reason why we took that title. But if that isn't a science fiction
yeah,
cover,
and that looks like it's straight out of Astounding
yeah,
stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Or,
because they all have that inherent thing.
Did
think,
they have the same artists? You would think.
I've looked him up. He did. He definitely did Flying Saucer. He did Mysteries. He also did, you know, he was like one of these jack of all trades.
Yeah,
so,
but any pulp-like.
And pulp-like, yeah, pulps basically and that sort of thing. But that was just, that's perfect. You know, it was just, and a lot of those covers.
I'm surprised they didn't get some Ed Emshwiller or Chesley Bonestell.
Well, that's the thing. They probably went as cheap as they could on these.
Yeah.
That was the first Flying Saucer book. And no one had any idea how they do. And it sold, you know, like something like 500,000 copies, I think. Just, you know, which wasn't chicken feed even in 1950.
Right.
So, and then other publishers would pick it up. So there's this huge interest in people seeing the most between 1947 and around 1955. That's when the report on unidentified flying objects came out and essentially said, nope, there are none. But it wasn't until 1969 with the scientific study of unidentified flying objects, the old Condon Committee.
Right.
You know, basically wrote Fini from the scientific viewpoint of flying saucers. In between, you'd had another flap. You'd had the 1965 to 1968 flap, which included everything from Barney and Betty Hill's abduction
mm-hmm.
in New Hampshire, the first actual abductees we have record of, you know, that were given.
I met them. I shouldn't say I met them. The best job ever that I had at WBAI was engineer.
Right.
And so I would be engineering other people's shows. So somebody else, I don't recall who, it was not Margot,
right,
had them live on the air.
Oh, wow.
And so I was the engineer.
Right.
So I say I met people when, in fact, I haven't, but I was in the same room
at
them, as close to them as I am to you. So. Yeah.
I have one of the books in the collection was autographed by her and signed with a little note to a friend.
Yeah.
So, and her husband died a long time before she did, I think. I think he had a heart attack or something, poor guy. So, but I just like, but they were the first abductees, and as opposed to contactees, who usually just saw the golden Skymen coming down, the super Aryans, you know, and the hair just glistening, and, you know, fancy ski pants, and, you know, just and talking about, and hi, my name is Erkin. Mm-hmm. I just like, and so just, you know, for some reason, I think it probably later explained my taste for Ed Wood movies, just the grotesque stupidity of it attracted me as a teenager. And then, as I got older, I continued to collect them, because at that point, and I was just watching to see how many different ways people could convince themselves of something or believe anything, essentially.
That's one of the most amazing things, isn't how sincere the abductees and contacted people. The one person who I've met a couple of times was close friends with Margot Adler, of course, is one of the most influential in more recent years, and that would be the fantasy and horror writer Whitley Strieber, Whitley.
Yeah.
And there's no question in his sincerity.
Right. That's what Ellen has told me. There's just like, you know, so obviously, but then my question was, what makes the believer the believer? And you know,
it's the awkward silence that
you have when you ask the question in other contexts, in a spiritual context or any sort of context such as that, because it's just very well. I mean,
but
just,
the difference between a spiritual thing is that spiritual people have faith.
But there are a number of like overlaps, of course, with religion and flying saucers. I just saucers are the work of the devil. That's one. Satanic terror. But then there's
that's others. Sort of an ongoing.
But then there's others.
So much is the work of the devil.
But then there are whole religions created from them. The Unarians, of course, with Ruth and Orman.
Right.
I'd
forgotten them.
Oh yeah. Well, that's because after when she finally died, you know, they couldn't have her on the Tonight Show anymore.
Right.
She was always a delight to see. And there are, of course, you've seen the pictures of her with her charioteers.
Yes.
And here, which is one of the greatest photos of all time.
Yeah, we should explain that while this book is filled with text and a lot of great writing, it is, as everybody pictures. Looking at the radio can tell, it's a coffee table book. What size do we call it? It's not bedrock size.
The old days you'd call it duodecimo. Wait a minute. No, you would call it the... there's one that starts with Q. Quarto. You'd call it a quarto.
Oh, it's a quarto.
I think so because a folio would be, you know, closer to like this, like here. This one would be a folio.
Okay, everybody, look at your radios.
Yeah, the face of Lincoln, all the known photographs at that time. So, but yeah, but this would be a quarto.
And now, I've seen a Shakespeare first folio, so
right,
I know.
Yeah,
I know what that looks like.
Yeah, but it's hard to remember the next one. Then you have an octavo, and then...
Which would be an eighth.
Right, and then you have duodecimo, which is the...
which would be half.
Yeah, the half.
Half a page.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's what these terms all mean.
Exactly. I'm convinced.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We're looking at a photo of hula girls and high above what seems to be a lens flare or a scratch on the lens.
It looks like a scratch on the lens,
something, yeah.
But it's also undeniably, being a scratch on the lens, it's undeniably a flying saucer.
Well, undeniably. And then you have the others.
Well, you can't deny it.
Then you have the other photos that where you can see the pie plate being lifted and thrown up into the sky, and you can only see the blur as it sort of comes back to Earth.
Yeah.
Then you can see the ones that were tied in place from the unseen
The Ed Wood method.
Exactly. And then I don't know how they ever did the one with the smoke.
They fix it in post. I was a hobbyist in photography.
Right.
And the answer, I think, is in the darkroom. You could take a little piece of, like, colored plastic, right. Like you would, you know, like a gel, and you'd put that on a stick. And as you are doing the exposure onto the plate, you can just sort of make little circles with that and make little cloudy formations. Because I once made clouds I didn't do it very long. I only did it in camp.
Right.
But I made clouds in photographs where there were no clouds. And I know that that's a real photograph of flying saucer, but... Well, I could do that in the dark room.
Yeah, exactly.
During the exposure process. Not that anybody would ever do that. Not that anybody would ever try to convince people fraudulently.
No. Now, the interesting thing has been since everyone has been carrying now a phone with a photograph with a camera in their pocket, how the number of flying saucer photos of Bigfoot, of the Loch Ness Monster have all plummeted.
I mean, isn't that interesting?
Them, but somehow there does seem to be
as photography has become
connection.
Ubiquitous.
And you can usually take, say, oh, I wish I had a camera. You know, you're always saying, it's like, oh, I have a camera. Boom, and you've got it.
Yeah.
So that just does not seem to happen very often. So,
yeah, it's a curious thing.
It's faded. Well, I don't...
I never thought about that.
Yeah, but. I think it's just like this just... proves, you know, you have to figure, well, it's probably happened, but you just haven't seen where.
Well, it just means that now that we all have cameras, the flying saucers are staying away.
Exactly.
That's the obvious logical answer.
Of course, that is. But, of course, think of the dash cams in Russia, the one that caught the meteor coming down.
Yes.
Which was truly a spectacular sight.
That was an amazing... There were even two...
Yeah.
Films. I mean, they are so ubiquitous, and in Russia, they might have even more desire to have stuff than is needed here, and needed here.
Oh,
there were actually two dash cam pictures of that meteor.
Right. And you can actually look at it and see similarities to older photos that may have still possessed that maybe quality to it, or basic, or more like, what is this? You know, it's obviously not a flying saucer, but what is it?
Well, that's what makes it unidentified.
Exactly. And then what became interesting was flying saucers.
I don't think anybody's ever had an IFO, an identified flying saucer.
Oh, I've seen the term down. The term is in a number of those books. Yeah, exactly. I was about to say, after the Condon Report's release, then what happened was flying saucers, it was an early case of the demographic splitting. And so you had suddenly the cattle mutilator crowd. Who believed in cattle, UFOs mutilating cattle. You had the abductee crowd.
Mm-hmm.
You had the crowd who started asking questions about the moon, since it was clear that no one lived there. Then the question was, our spaceship moon? We never went to the moon. You know, the moon is hollow. Just all of these, you know, loony things. And then the resurgent of the sort of loopiness that you'd seen in earlier periods from the reprints of all the old New Age stuff going back to the 20s. And then the development of cults in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and stronger cults. And that was arising also partially out of Manson, since the crime, you know, crime and this, all of these subjects overlap. And just, and it by the time of the 80s, it was like techniques are already starting to be applied that would result in the sort of alternate reality that we had by the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a perceived alternate reality that some people live in. And the thing is, you can't live in a true because there can be no alternate reality.
Right.
So, and this is what is clearly one of the things that's splitting the Republicans. I mean, it serves them right, but they've taken it way too far. They took it way too far. Trump, I'm just terrible. I just want to get...
I'm going
to be there at 6:05. I'm going to be there at 6:05, if not 6, to be...
Yeah.
It is one of the scariest days.
Yeah.
The approach of that date is so frightening.
Right, I know.
No matter what assurances the New York Times gives us.
No, I know. Oh, God, no, not at all. I just, like, I've been trying to think back and compare it to see if this year actually was worse than 1968, which up to now was the sixth worst one I could recall, but there weren't any assassinations this year.
No, no, so far. Just character assassinations. Or
enormous amounts of character assassination, just really... And character assassinations against the army, against, you know, individual, you know, POWs, against the Gold Star families. And they're just going to keep going after the election either way, because it's like Trump came along and turned over every single rock in the backyard.
Yeah, I've been calling it for a year now, Weimar, New York.
Yeah, so...
It really has, I mean, my parents lived through... Right. The Weimar era in Germany. My father in Nuremberg, my mother in Frankfurt and Prague.
Mm-hmm.
So they were teenagers, younger, a little younger than teenagers.
But they know what to look for. They recognize, because it's just like, because as soon as he got away with calling McCain, you know, a loser, you know.
Yeah.
As they let him get away with that. And
McCain didn't, but the media did.
No, but the media did.
But Trump is one of them. Trump is a media guy.
Yeah, he's a TV guy.
And my own personal theory about Trump,
he
has no intention of winning. He doesn't want to win. He's a media. He wants to build a media empire, and the whole purpose of his running in this election is so that he can now start an empire to rival Murdoch.
That's possibly how he started out, but I think
he's
taken too much interest in possibilities now.
Well, yeah, I mean, his own demagogue, so...
I just, like, and he's getting, because he's been getting progressively worse and more incoherent and just, and yet retains so many...
Well, getting worse would follow my theory that he doesn't want to win.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is the frightening thing in the since the FBI entered the political race, or at least the director, Trump has gained major points.
Yeah, exactly. They're starting to slip back down again, but he definitely was a rise right after the last weekend.
Yeah,
that was just amazing. I'm waiting to see what they're going to break today. Since it's Friday.
Oh, yeah, the last Friday before.
Yeah. So I've heard, you know, rumors that's going to be something about Trump that's coming out, but I have no idea, and I doubt it somehow, so...
I wouldn't be surprised. Monday wouldn't be too late either, because news cycles are so fast.
Well, I can remember when George W. Bush's drunk driving ticket came up, and that was like the Friday or the Monday before the election. It made no difference. So
no, but the internet was not as ingrained as a news cycle as it is today.
Not at all. I mean, the Talking Points memo only started that year. A lot of the political blogs only started that year because of the election. And just like I remember from what I remember. So, because prior to that, I just remember...
But it still took like a week for Breitbart or somebody like that to get their venom spread around.
Exactly.
And today, it's a matter of hours.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, or minutes, for that matter.
Yeah, but saturate the American consciousness, it's a matter of hours.
Oh, exactly.
Because, you know, you might be driving somewhere and not checking your...
Yeah.
A Twitter feed.
And
or
I
something.
Knew there'd be a tremendous amount of misogyny in the election. What I wasn't expecting to still exist at such strong levels among more people than I would expect was anti-Semitism.
Well, yeah, and the anti-Semitism would be so much worse if it were Sanders running.
Yeah.
Which is one reason why I was always convinced Sanders could never win the election. I think a woman would have an easier time than a Jew.
maybe not Hillary. I mean, I think she'll have as hard a time as they can possibly give her.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, yeah, but, you know, it's funny how people love and respect her when she holds office, like senator in New York or something like
right.
that. And the moment she's running, it's total hatred and
oh,
you're
it's
a
amazing.
Crook.
It's
and,
really astounding. Yeah, it's really astounding.
But it's no different than the hatred people had for her during
right.
what is now called the Clinton years.
Right, yeah.
You know, before the whole Monica Lewinsky thing,
right. yeah.
they were going after her with Whitewater.
Oh, Vince Foster, the airport in Arkansas.
Rush Limbaugh made a career out of nothing but loathing
and so,
Hillary Clinton.
So did Drudge, I mean, for that matter. I mean,
yes.
They both did.
Well, Drudge had was aiming as much or more at Bill.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
Limbaugh focused
yeah.
on Hillary.
Well, yeah, of course, he's a bully. So,
yeah.
naturally, you know, whereas, you know,
This is one of the scariest
yeah.
elections of all time. This is
it
the
really
first
is.
One that, you know, makes me think. I think if my father were alive, and mm-hmm. I don't discuss his career on the air.
Right,
but
yeah.
he was in the government.
Right.
And I think he would be thinking about going back to Germany or something.
Well, this entire thing, as soon as it became clear what degree the FBI seems to be involved in it, or at least the New York
at least
branch.
Yes.
So
and the director.
And the director. It's just like, this is what...
He's brought us back to the days of Hoover.
Yeah, which takes
And he's an
doing.
Obama appointee. That's what I don't
well, he's,
get, is why Obama
he's
got him.
Because that way Obama could say, I appointed a Republican, see?
And look at
and
what
look
he got
at,
for it.
Well, precisely.
You sow what you reap.
Precisely. You wouldn't see...
Or you other way around.
You wouldn't have seen LBJ do anything like that. I mean,
yeah.
you know, just like, you know, there's party and then there's party. And so, you know, you understand to be loyal, but you've got to be at the same time. And there hasn't been as much wimping out this year as I've seen it.
The horrifying thing is
yeah.
how we're still on topic about UFOs.
With yeah.
this discussion, because
yes.
it's all about American credibility.
Exactly. And the thing is, as individual things become less believable, even in reality, in scientific advances, in climate change, and just as these things make themselves evident, it's still like you can stay in the alternate reality that has somehow been created, at least for a partial generation, just before people realize, wait a minute, it floods New York every month now.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. Or people start, you know, just seeing, my Social Security check's been cut in half. Oh, it's only till you see what winds up changing and who knows what that will be.
And even then people look for the alternate reality
yeah.
reasons for those things to have changed.
Right, right. We deserve it, you know, and that's where it always we deserve it. Trump is like a Berlusconi with teeth. I mean, it's really scary because he's you know,
yeah.
this basically publicity-hungry, womanizing mogul, or would-be mogul is more the question.
It's more accurate.
I think that my best part of the Democratic convention for me, outside of Michelle, was a brief interview they did with Bloomberg, who showed up, as he was a member of the New York delegation, I believe, and they had him on, and Bloomberg demolished him in like 5 minutes, you know, at the time.
As one New York wealthy person.
I'm from New York. Listen, I know this type. He's a con artist.
Yeah.
And Bloomberg was the one who spoke the most directly and most, you know, I mean, I know this type. You know, I'm from New York. This is a con man. And
I'm from New York in wealthy circles.
Yeah. Exactly, and the circles that he's never admitted to. Trump,
yeah.
I mean, they never let him into the Maidstone. I'm sure they never let him into any of those places.
Yeah.
And just, it pisses him off.
That's why he had to have his own building so he could go in, I guess.
And has his name on giant letters on every one
of
them.
Although I've heard had
some,
his name
some,
in giant letters.
Some are being taken down, some they're renaming the new ones.
Well, because he doesn't own them.
No, of course not. Other people are
in debt. He's been in default on almost all of his property.
Other people are in debt because of him, while he's still made out like a bandit.
I mean, pyramid scheme.
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, I can't even look at him, or lately I can look at him, and I'm going to see really bad moon rising, as it were. But, but prior to that, I could never look at him without thinking, and your second prize, a set of steak knives, because it's obvious it's boiler room tactics. It was just so, it's like on The Sopranos. It's just like, they're going to break it out. They're going to just, gut it and then run off with the goods and, escape to Argentina.
Yeah, that are credible. To me, the most frightening thing, Trump, it's
Mitch McConnells, the Paul Ryans, the ones that...
It's the low-level people online. I saw a post by a person who I don't personally know in science fiction fandom.
Right.
Put a post on Facebook.
Right.
Echoing, trying to make it sound reasonable, but echoing all the Trump talking points.
Oh, yeah, right.
And to which my only response was bye-bye, and for the first time ever, I actually unfriended somebody Facebook, because I don't use Facebook that much. I use it to publicize the things that I do, Twitter even less.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But
with me, it's the reverse. I use Twitter a lot more, so I'm fairly fast on it and
do
it with things. Well, Facebook, I just, I put stuff on there, but I just... It's just sort of the opposite, and I think both of us are lost when it comes to, like, Snapchat.
Yeah.
I cannot reach the 18-year-olds, even though my daughter was funny. I was on one day on a podcast called Sweet, and so I said, okay, whatever, it sounds good to me. And I tell my daughter, who's 13, "You're on Sweet? Really?
Uh-huh.
Really? You really are famous." Which is a wonderful thing to hear, actually. So, but it was on some sort of Snapchat. Apparently, they have individual programs as well, like on the or podcast or something.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So.
And Periscope is doing that as well.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
YouTube was there a long time ago. And Livestream is doing it, and I have the reading series that you will be appearing at February.
Oh, excellent.
Oh, you didn't know we're on?
Huh? February 7th, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, I've got the date down.
Can watch you live and after the fact.
Right.
Oh, we are a channel.
Very good. I always tried with Ellen to do that at KGB, but she wouldn't even pull the curtains open. I mean, it was always so dark in there, you couldn't film.
No, you can't even take photographs there.
No, it's a shame.
I tried filming there.
It's a shame, too, because they've had some really good people showing up.
Well, we get the audio.
Yeah,
I used to record all of them. Gordon Lindsner,
right?
Initially, was recording it for me,
right?
And now he turns it over to Ellen and Matt,
right?
And emails it to me, so I'm still getting it.
Right,
I'm still getting all the, and because my radio show now is Wednesday nights, I really can't go Wednesday evening,
right,
to KGB.
Right.
But mine is on live stream. I have a fellow running. We have three cameras. It's not set and forget. We're doing cross.
Right.
We're doing the whole thing.
Right.
The fellow who is my technical director is a person who produces pledge breaks for PBS.
Well, I've had people come over.
Science fiction writer, too.
Very good. I've had people come over here and do, interviews on film. They put on their own film channel, They come over. One fellow I know who's an appraiser for Christie's. Came over to show the book collection and everything, and so there's a little 5 minutes.
Yeah, I should be taking a couple of pictures, by the way.
You'd better, because I'm going to try to be selling it this year. So.
Oh, now, yeah, I was thinking, to start with, of you.
Oh, yeah, well, that's a good idea. The light should be reasonably good here.
Yeah, my phone is not a great camera phone, but it's quite adequate.
Right, right.
It's a three-year-old.
Let's see how it looks, because you can always use mine if this one.
Oh, I think if I can find where the camera app is.
All right.
Okay. And I hope you're all enjoying this on the air. Actually, it looks pretty decent. I will show it to you. Here's a little thing. I like that when you take the picture, you can actually go into your photo collection automatically.
Oh, that's nice.
And it's already online.
Right. Oh, seriously.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, very good.
Absolutely. Oh, the joys of...
Email me the link.
Now it's online.
Okay.
It took that long.
Yeah,
The lighting isn't great.
It's a little blurry.
Yeah. I'll take another. But what I'll do is I'll take a few, and then I'll just send you the link to all of them.
Okay.
But it's... talking about the ability, first of all, that angle will be better. We'll be cutting this out of the recording, by the way. And let me also do a close-up now.
Okay.
There we go. I'm not a great photographer with this, but they're so automated.
Right, they are. I know. It's cameras for idiots, I call them, because I can always say great shots with mine.
Yeah, I'm an audio person myself.
Yeah, I just know how to... I have an eye for composition, but beyond that, no real... You know, if I had to go into the dark room, forget it. I'd have no idea what to do.
Yeah, well, I was never good with a camera, but I knew how to use a dark room.
Of course,
Of
course, last year, my daughter, at one point, we were talking about something I referred to, film, and she says, "What's film?"
Right.
And it's just like, it was one of those moments that just bring you up short and realize, oh, they're not going to remember that.
Well, no, they'll know the word.
Yeah.
Everybody who uses their iPhone or their Android device to dial a phone, outside of a movie, they have never seen a phone dial in their life.
Yeah, they just usually it's a one click because they've got the number already in the machine.
Oh, I don't bother with that. I just say to my phone
who
to call, and it does it.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, we are at that point. And what's more, you can use the command dial Jack Womack.
Right, yeah.
And they're
getting better at picking up voices that even are a little blurry sometimes. So,
yes, the voice recognition has gone
much better. Yeah, that's getting
a very
much better.
Long way now. Yeah. Where did I put my photo app? Probably right next to I put it right next to the camera app. That would
That makes sense.
Yeah, actually, it does make sense. How about that? Let's see now.
That one's fine.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah, let's see.
That was the close-up I took.
Yeah.
I can fix that in post, as they say.
Yeah.
I just took a series right there.
Yeah.
That's blurry.
Yeah, I think the first one of this series is probably...
This one?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
See what you think, but I think that one and the other where I'm sitting are the close-up is good.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, those look fine.
And just so you can see, this is... I had Douglas Cohen, who with John Joseph Adams put out a book called What the Bleep Is That?
Right. I think I remember it.
I had them at BAI posed with the seven words you can't say on
Except now you can say most of them. At least I've heard most of them on network TV.
And that was actually thanks to the fact that we lost the case.
Yeah. So,
but that's a whole other story.
It is.
But that was people forget that was WBAI.
Yeah, I remember now.
The problem was we would have won, except for the fact that it was on Saturday at 2:00 p.m.
Ooh,
so that was the so actually, if you think about it,
you guys should have started at midnight.
Sense.
Yeah.
It's 10 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Right.
Is what they call safe harbor.
Right, yeah.
And you can do it almost anywhere except at Pacifica Radio.
Right,
not because there is any prurient interest at Pacifica, but because of fear of what the cost of lawsuit.
Right, exactly. Having already gone through it once, they don't want to do it again.
But there's a secret that I know about how it really didn't cost us a lot.
Right.
Well, that's very simple. We never paid the lawyers.
Oh, the Donald Trump method.
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, we made them very wealthy.
They were not
very well known First Amendment law firm, they did such a great job representing us to the Supreme Court, CBS.
Yeah.
And they represent CBS and Fox.
Right, yeah.
Other places. So they're a huge law firm today because they did the Carlin case.
Those are some powerhouses.
So they took the loss of our not paying them off their taxes became a huge law firm.
Right.
I think they did okay.
They did okay. They would do okay with that. I forgot. Businesses can write it off. So just
absolutely. Bad debt.
Yep, exactly.
So if Donald Trump owes you money, you can write it off.
Yep. Thank goodness he doesn't. At least not directly.
Not directly. You never know because he owns so much.
Oh, I know. But as far as I know, I've never stayed at a Trump hotel or, anything. Just briefly. I made a point of not going into it during that brief period he owned the Plaza Hotel. Which he probably never paid for either. But I didn't go in at any point. I think the Oak Room might have shuttered then. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I don't recall
that was very brief.
Yeah, it was like 2 months. It was like 2 or 3 months. Just like his plan to build a skyscraper twice as big as the Empire State Building, like in Trump City down here, which no one calls a Trump City. They just say those apartments. It's just that wall of things that block off the view of the river from everyone who lives, in West End and everyone.
I do remember one of the first things he did in New York was he helped rebuild the ice skating rink in Central Park.
Well, actually, he did that. It was like in the early 80s. That was the one thing he did that seems to have actually been... Yeah, I'm sure
on the up and up.
On the up and up. Well, he seems to have done it with someone else's money, I'm sure. But that person would have actually gotten something back, because I think, or more likely, if I remember right, I remember he contributed it to the city of New York.
Yeah.
And because the city had been reconstructing it for like 4 years, I remember it was closed for then about 4 years, and everybody was just thinking, well, it'll never open again. And Trump came in, and I'm sure his workers are all legal, and the polls and everyone, they tend to favor for his construction projects in the early 80s. And, they had it fixed and running, and it's been running well since, in 6 months. And they did the one up here, too, Lasker Rink. And those are, were done correctly.
Is the first one, the Wollman Rink, is still called the Wollman Rink?
It's still called the Wollman Rink. Yeah. He did not rename it. I think there's probably something. It's like in Chicago, how most Trump Towers look pretty awful and banal and at the same time. The one in Chicago is not bad. It's very tall. It's north of the Loop. It's got curving sides. I think they have strict architectural standards in Chicago that I think he had to build it where it fit in naturally with the skyline. And the only problem has been that since then, he added the giant letters Trump in gold right at the top.
Of course.
He can't help himself.
So anybody in Lake Michigan could...
Exactly. It blocks it. You can't look at it anymore without seeing Trump, And that was one of the best things about it. It was very spare and just a nice color and the rounded corners and just very nice.
Well, now it can say Cubs.
It was only 108 years.
So. Yeah, Amir, as an old-time Mets fan, when I still followed baseball, you have to love the Cubs.
Marvelous Marv.
Absolutely. When New York fought Chicago for the basement. Which was the worst team.
I remember those days.
I love those days. Ernie Banks.
What do you want to do? Go to a Mets Padres game? I remember that too. Because they were always, as bad almost. But being so close here.
Yeah, but that's already 80s.
You're talking about.
I'm talking 60s.
Yeah, you're talking Marvelous Marv and all the other.
Casey Stengel as manager before Gil Hodges took over.
Beautiful Casey Stengel.
Yeah, I mean those
they
were
don't make them like that. Anymore.
Those were the Mets.
Yeah.
For me, yeah. And I grew up in Jackson Heights.
Right.
So I could walk to Shea Stadium.
Oh, nice. When it was still $5 a ticket or something.
No, it was less than didn't cost $5. Grandstand was about like $1.50.
That's amazing. Then they
$5 should get you field.
And then they ask, why aren't the kids of today interested in baseball? Just like, when have they ever seen a real one except at a minor league stadium?
Yeah. Well, I stopped.
And those are usually fun, or used to be. I don't know what they're like now.
I don't go anymore. I stopped being a fan after the second strike. But I found baseball again.
Yeah.
Now that I live in Brooklyn.
Right.
I follow the Brooklyn Cyclones.
Yeah, the minor league. I was just
which is owned. It's all the way down. It's what they used to call Bush League until Bush gave everything a bad name.
Right.
And the Cyclones are A ball. Triple A is almost just below major league.
Right.
Double A is
and then A.
So the Cyclones are an A league.
Well, I always wondered where they fell on the the lineup there, because I've seen the Trenton Thunderbirds. That was a wonderful.
Yeah, I think they're also A ball.
Yeah, and they were. It was like
part,
basically
it's
you
the
walked
Penn
in.
New York League
yeah.
is the name of the league,
yeah.
and it's terrible baseball. You'll have a wonderful.
Yeah,
time.
No, that was exactly how I found it. Yeah, the baseball
exactly.
was ridiculous,
you can
but they had race. They had ball. You know,
you're five blocks from Nathan's Hot Dogs.
You had races to,
Well, they have the races between.
Yeah.
It's sponsored by Burger King, so between
mascots,
the mustard pack and
right,
the ketchup pack.
Exactly. Yeah. No. Exactly.
Fireworks almost every game.
Yep.
People
yep.
shooting T-shirts into
yep.
the stands.
Yep. No, they're fun.
Top ticket price when it started was $9.
Yeah.
Most expensive ticket.
Yeah, I remember. It was incredibly cheap.
Yeah, and even now the top ticket is like $20.
Right, yeah, that's not bad.
And,
it's really good for,
and it's a nice day at the, it's like George Carlin used to say, it's a game. You go to the park to watch people play.
Yeah.
And, that's supposed to be the spirit, not the football gridiron.
It's, right.
Carlin does a great thing on the language between football and baseball.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
And,
so,
and
yeah.
That he's fictional. W.P. Kinsella.
Oh yeah.
View
Kinsella,
of
right.
baseball
yes.
is the kind that I've got.
Oh yes, no, that's okay.
So go Chicago,
Exactly. Well, let's see. Was the old time nostalgia hour over at this point, or let's see?
I think so.
Right.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the book.
Okay.
And actually,
well, you must have some questions.
Well, why? I do. But so many of them are unanswerable, which is why are people so credulous?
It's people have always been. That's the basis of religion in one degree.
I mean,
that someone. You
but
can't
religion
see.
Serves a purpose of teaching. Or guarding over morality and ethics.
Well,
it's supposed to.
So it's supposed to
on the books.
It depends
in the
on
books.
It depends on the religion. Some it's more like a societal binding,
Yeah.
With others, it's definitely crime and punishment.
Yeah.
So it just varies from religion. Others are for us.
So I'm saying is that religion actually serves a social purpose to those. Who follow it.
Definitely. Whereas flying saucers, if you follow those yet believe in them, they don't necessarily lead anywhere good. In fact, if you remember, they were initially called Bo and Peep. It was a man and woman in Oregon who showed up claiming to be aliens. Well, they're the ones who later transmogrified into Heaven's Gate.
Aha, of course.
And then, and led themselves in 99 to a one of the few mass suicides we had before the millennium started.
Yeah, so that they could appear on an asteroid somewhere.
Exactly.
Or something like that,
exactly.
As it came
much more
close to Earth.
Much more harmful than Ruth Norman, who is out, with her Unarians, was basically out just to wear nice costumes and flounce around and just have a parade and just have a good time, which is the subject in which very few flying saucer people have ever approached it like like Ruth Norman did. And
Did you talk to any of the Philip class, not related to William Ten?
I talked to nine because I wanted this completely coming from what I knew about them, my personal experience with the books.
Right.
So each book has a description, but you know, they tend to be a little more straightforward than they used to be during the time. I just like it when I have, for example, in Adam C.'s book, I open up, Polish-born George Adamski arrived in Laguna Beach in the late 1930s, where he founded the Royal Order of Tibet. When you have facts like that, why fancy them up? I just like, with most of these books that I still have, it's the same way. You can pull any line from them, and just it makes as much sense as the next line, or as least sense as the next one.
Yeah.
But the saucer books are all written, and there's this quality of innocence to even the worst at this stage. But it's later that they, when they get picked up by, I mean, I have one of the books, a couple of the books in my collection are UFOs and Nazis, and just like secret Nazi polar expeditions, and, you know, and things that are just like, you know, where Hitler escaped to Argentina or Antarctica in a flying saucer and that sort of thing, which first came out in the early 60s when the Hitler is still alive myth was still active and going on. But then it became like Hitler is still alive because he got out in a flying saucer, which is like the easiest and newest conveyance for him to be theoretically escaping in. Yeah. So
It reminds me a little, have you, of... there's a documentary by Werner Herzog about the Loch Ness Monster.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Oh,
that one's there.
This is a wonderful
movie. I like most all of his.
Of his are proper documentaries.
Right, right.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams and things like that. His one, I'll have to look up the title, where he gets on a boat and he's on the Loch Ness with an exobiologist.
I'm going to look this up.
Very memorable about the exobiologist. His name is... I think it was Zach Penn. And
So there was a Zach Penn.
But what happens?
We are talking very special people.
In the course of this movie, Mr. Penn is killed by the monster. The monster comes out, starts threatening people and people in the ship.
I'm sure I've read about this
documentary.
Movie.
Are dying one by one, exobiologist.
Yeah, I'm sure I've read.
Ends up being killed, and with Werner Herzog was the only survivor.
Right,
Zach Penn today.
Right,
since he was killed, then is one of the people who's producing movies for Marvel.
Yeah, that's where I've seen the name. Yeah,
yes, yeah. But he was killed.
Right. Yes. Well, of course.
On the Loch in the documentary, and at no point does the documentary wink.
No. Well, that's the same with that. Sounds like with Peter Jackson's Forgotten Silver.
To an extent, but he was a little bit more winking at the audience.
Right, there was definitely...
Where Herzog...
Herzog would naturally play it German, so it'd be very, very serious.
He was absolutely, from beginning to
you
end...
You have to be.
Even as all the people who are all working to get today get
you have to be.
Killed off one by one.
Right.
So he really ought to... I think he would have a lot of fun with your book.
It's going to be published. Well, it's available from Amazon UK now. So it's also available from Amazon here in the US now as well.
Okay.
So it's being sold and should be showing up in some of your better independent bookstores across the country. And, you know, and it's a fine gift buying guide.
It really is.
Because you just buy a copy of this and keep your friends entertained.
And who's the publisher?
Anthology, which is broken off from, you know, the Anthology Film Archives downtown.
Oh, really?
Yep, it's just like they're separated, but it's like, but stems from that, and also Anthology Music.
Okay,
Anthology's newest publication is John Savage on the Sex Pistols
with
illustrations, which is quite good, quite good.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful beautifully published.
This is
published.
Well, I know
book.
The...
weighty book.
It is weighty. It is weighty. If there's a second... there might be a second edition. Who knows? But because I think it's... I've just gotten the reviews. It has been ridiculously good.
The reviews are fabulous.
And they've
National
shown up everywhere.
Reviews,
yeah, they've shown up everywhere.
Washington Post and the rest.
Yeah. So since I'm going to sell off the rest of the books...
Are you now?
I'm pretty sure I'm going to, yeah. Just because... I mean, I've had them for so many years, and the collecting is fun, but except for a couple, once you have them, then, you know, you just don't read them anymore.
I should probably, now it's primarily this one shelf, right?
No, it's pretty
much... Oh, it's the corner?
No, it's pretty much everything in here. And,
oh, okay.
And also in that case.
Wow, okay. Well, I'm going to take
a picture
of the corner.
Yeah, that's the easiest way to do it. Yeah, and that's the... Hardcore forte in cryptozoology.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and you say that, and of course that reminded me, of course, that before Flying Saucers, there was Lowe, and there was Charles Fort,
and the 14th. Oh yeah, exactly.
And all that, and some crackpots who weren't crackpots, like Velikovsky,
right?
Who as.
Velikovsky was a true crackpot.
But some of his stuff turned out to be quite... was revealed
right.
over time. Mm-hmm. And people are now starting to de-crackpotize Fred Hoyle.
Right.
The science fiction writer astronomer.
Well, I have... One of the books in here was written by Hoyle under a pseudonym.
Oh, what? Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Which one is it?
I did not realize.
Yeah, I don't actually name him, as it's never been proven, but that one.
Flying Saucers from Mars by Frederick Allingham.
The involvement of a well-known, recently deceased British astronomer in the writing of this wholly fraudulent account has long been hinted, but never confirmed. Peter Davies, a friend of the aforementioned astronomer, admitted in the mid-1980s to being one of the book's two authors, and also claimed to have at least once given a talk early on at a Flying Saucer Club posing as Allingham while wearing a false mustache.
Ah, okay. And they must have had fun with that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But Hoyle's astronomically speaking, or cosmologically speaking, he believed in the solid-state universe, as opposed to...
I remember, yes.
Absolutely. And he was the one who once said, what, do you really believe that the universe began with a big bang? Yes. And it was totally a derisive thing,
right.
And that's the name that caught on. He named it.
Right.
The theory that he did not believe in as the big bang, and now... people are starting to say, well, there are questions.
Right, yeah.
And it could be that everything exists so that both aspects of the Big Bang Theory and Hoyle's static universe theory are not necessarily battling each other.
Right.
Yeah. And that Hoyle's totally in keeping with Einstein.
Yeah,
that's an important little aspect. So he was
Hoyle, I always considered an actual scientist, just with different theory, but an actual scientist who had arrived at his conclusion by the scientific method.
Yeah, he also rubbed elbows with Richard Feynman. The good people.
Yeah, seriously good.
So you never know about people who are sometimes labeled
as
crackpots.
No, I think Charles Fort should be in the Library of America.
There's a thought.
If Lovecraft is in the Library of America, Charles Fort should be.
Jonathan Lethem seems to have pull with them. So
yeah. Oh yeah. Well, there should be.
Maybe a buzz in his ear.
Jonathan got a copy. He blurbed it, but it came in so late it had to be in a sticker. But he got it already, I think, on the... Oh, well, here, I've got some... Yeah, do I have one under here? Not out anymore. Oh, yeah, too far over. Anyway, but the study, yes, there was a sticker from Jonathan.
Oh, that's great.
So,
yeah. So, let's briefly set the Wayback Machine a little further.
Right.
You're not writing fiction anymore.
I've got one on the back burner at the moment. But I've just I've been.
When was your last?
2000.
Yeah.
So then I wrote a short story for ARC, the Infinity.
Right.
For a few years ago. And then seeing the reaction to this has made me think I better stay in this field a little bit longer because, for one thing, I have a lot more books to describe and can likely describe them in the same way.
Yeah.
So in the same format, and then have two ugly coffee table books. Where basically I don't have to have the library because I'll have the books all conveniently in two-volume form.
It's curated compact edition.
Exactly, exactly.
Of your library.
Exactly. That's why I'm just going to be writing up a list of high spots this next 2 weeks just to get them, just to see what there is I have. But the Flying Saucer books, it was interesting because it wasn't until the guys came over and backed up, boxed them up, and then took them down to the gallery. And this was like when they were first, you know, brought over like 5-6 years ago. It wasn't until they were spread out and you could see all the covers at once facing you, as opposed to just the spines, that it's just suddenly you realize you're looking at some totally subgenre of art that hadn't yet been recognized.
Yeah.
Which is why another reason why we wanted to do it so, you know, so well done.
And so the show was born, the exhibit.
Yeah, the show.
Traveling exhibit.
Exactly. It was kind of, or just, you know, just from here to Georgetown, basically, or, you know, University
in
D.C. And so it would be those two places. I was here, and I don't know what date is going to be in D.C. I think maybe March, but I'm not for certain on that.
Well, we can find out and put this up. This will be online, if nowhere else, still in March. So
we'll
update wherever that is.
Sounds good. Well, I'll be certainly tweeting about it. So.
Okay, good.
So, anyhow, but yeah, so I've been doing that, and I just like, there is a, I am trying to do a revision of the first chapter of a now discarded book that just to send it out, a short story of just, made it, and it always was a standalone sort of thing to the book I was writing, and it's set in 1786.
Which book is it affiliated
it's
with?
It came out of, it's going to be the family book. I can't remember which title I had on it. But I realized to write in the mindset of characters who lived in the 1890s, and he's a little older than this because he's a young fella in this story. Since I always pour myself into the mind of my characters to whatever degree possible, I just realized I would have to be too racist.
Yeah.
It's impossible to do an accurate rendition of anything in the South before 1970, I think. To do it really accurately, you just can't do it. I mean,
I question parts of the South today.
It'll be like, you know, you'll have a guide saying which counties to avoid and just, you know, Davis County here. Just like, I mean, it's terrible, but, you know, it's true. So, yeah.
So let us recap especially for those people that need to do their holiday shopping. The book is Flying Saucers Are Real, _R.
Countless hours of top-notch entertainment.
It really is, by Jack Womack, W-O-M-A-C-K, with an intro by William Gibson, not the playwright.
No miracle worker here.
No miracle worker. Author of one of my, I should have brought it up earlier, Heirs of the Perisphere.
That's Howard Waldrop.
Oh, that's
You're thinking of the Grimsback Continuum.
That's it. I always conflate the titles.
The first thing of Bill's I ever read was the Grimsback Continuum.
That's a Flying Saucer story.
It is. It's like it's the 30, as if the 39 future had happened, and it has have Merv Ken, who talks about the contactee seeing the Barhade floating in the air.
Yeah, and when you hear that description, that doesn't tell you about the story because it's actually an extremely deep story that resonates anybody.
It showed tremendous skill, so I was deeply impressed when I read that. So.
And so that story deserves To be read along with Flying Saucers Are Real.
It's probably good. I think it's in the new Oxford Companion to English Literature, I think. It's
going really?
To be, I think so. I think wow. That's the one they picked, yeah.
It's a good one to choose.
It's an excellent one to choose. It's an
that one or New Rose City.
New Rose Hotel.
New Rose Hotel.
Yeah.
With the least known William Gibson movie, I think.
I think so. It's an interesting movie. It's far more interesting. I'd rather watch it than Johnny Mnemonic.
Generally. Oh, yeah.
But definitely very few people have really seen that movie.
It's an unknown movie.
Was it ever released on DVD? It was Abel Ferrara. I think it was released on DVD. I honestly don't know.
I have an illegitimate copy of it.
Right, yeah. So I remember it being not bad at all. Not bad at all. And plus, Abel Ferrara directed it, so you've got some talent back there. Yeah. So,
well, thank you so much. Well, it's been too long.
It has.
And I may run this just shortly before you're going again, before you're going to be reading for us with Jim Morrow in February of 2017 at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Which will be fun. It'll be good to see old Jim again.
Yeah. I think it's a good pairing, if I say so.
I do too. I think we might. I can't remember. 25 years ago, we might have had a similar pairing.
Maybe that's where it came to me from.
Maybe at old KGB or something.
No, 25 years ago, KGB didn't exist. It was just Nirsif with Gordon Van Gelder running it.
Oh, but that was one that took place at that on the Bowery.
Yes.
Yes, okay, that's the one I'm thinking.
That was Nirsif.
Okay, Nirsif. Okay,
yeah. KGB is new in the game. They're only about 18 or 19 years old.
Yeah. Right, yeah, that's right.
We're in our 26th season, so they're newbies. So
they are, yeah. I can always confuse them.
I've been doing it for 12 years now.
Right.
But I'm the 8th curator.
Right.
And Matt and Ellen are only the 3rd generation.
Right, I think. Yeah.
Because Alice Turner and Mark Jacobson.
Right.
Then Alice and Terry Bisson.
Right.
Then just Terry, I think.
Yeah, just Terry did for a while. That's where I met Luke Sante. So
right.
That would have been 1990.
Yeah, and then Gavin Grant and Kelly Link.
Right, yep.
And then Ellen Datlow, who was Ellen Datlow and Gavin Grant.
Right.
Because Kelly was...
Right.
Her star was starting to really shine at that moment.
Right.
And then Gavin decided that he couldn't commute every month from Northampton.
Right.
And she brought in Matt Kressel.
Right, right. So...
So they're all newbies, you know.
It's been a long year.
Yeah, but when you did that was at Dixon Place.
Right, that's what I did there. I think I did that more often than Nirsif. So
No, that was Nirsif.
Oh, okay, that's it. All right.
Our 8th or 9th incarnation.
I think I've done KGB maybe more than I've done Nirsif. But I can't remember how many times.
No, I have recordings of every single one of both.
Sure, yeah.
I think you did about four Nirsif and three KGBs.
It makes sense, because one would have followed each new book, and so that makes sense.
Although we try not to have the same people. We try to have a buffer of about 3 months before and after.
Yeah, I remember that. It always worked out fine.
This
has been out since September, but just now it should be found in stores and Amazon and other great places.
Great.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And we'll do this again sooner.
Well, yes.
Okay.
And you're in tune to Rabbit Station WBAI.
You have been listening to an interview with Jack Womack, conducted November of this year, 16. And I'll trust that you enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun. And Jack is a lot of fun. So, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you very much for listening. Join us in the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. Be sure to show up this coming Monday, December 12th at 7 p.m. for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings holiday event with Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. And everybody, please be good to each other, because you deserve it and we deserve it. Take care. Good morning.
Immigrants, workers, people of color, white workers who made the mistake of voting for him. We're going to form the kind of coalition that is going to change this country.
Hector Figueroa, president of 32BJ, SEIU. WBAI stands with Figueroa and all people standing against racism, against hate, xenophobia, misogyny.
We don't want to be fighting over which chair we're going to be sitting on the Titanic. We need to find a different boat. Maybe we'll have more than one vote. Maybe we'll keep the name. But certainly the politics of the Democratic Party, as it has been up until today, have failed us at least in 2010 and, quite frankly, over the last 25 years.
And that's why a listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station right in the center of the FM dial is needed. Stand with us. Become a listener sponsor of WBAI. Go to give2wbai.org. And thank you.
Hi, this is Jake Sufnarowski, former talent buyer at Wetlands Preserve. When I'm not driving my gas-guzzling SUV, texting my friends in my handheld mobile device, or listening to my local Clear Channel affiliate, I'm definitely tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York City, 99.5 FM.
And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. When I leave, you're going to remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Yeah, 99.5 WBAI, burn, baby, burn.
The red, white, the blue, I'm not Captain America, too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech, and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression, let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth, put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience, have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth, that's off the way I see it, well I'm going off, berserk, cause the system works, jerk, my people, the people, all around. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies the pigs make up.
to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Think a list of back on the radio, burning the imperialist red, white, and blue of glory with no apology for political reasons. Why not? Why not? Burn it. And if it won't burn, guess what we do? Dip it in acid so it burn, baby, burn. Yeah. The white supremacist says that this show is illegal, y'all. Y'all. These are political times. Get political or die. Burn this imperialist red, white, and blue. Vicious flag to ashes. Yes, I am.
The music sweet, you have to move your feet. Get up and rock, get up out of your seat. Get up out of your avenue, get up out of your street. Yeah, yo, cause when the music hit, you feel no pain. Tell the selector, pull up, pull up, pull up, and wheel it up again. Yeah, yeah. Give me some greens for my brain, cause the music driving me insane. The flow so volcanic, them can't stand it, them panic when them violate the order, the love upon all of them. Tell pagans and Babylon to line up with them turn. See to the end of the air while fire burn. Yeah, we bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah, yeah, yeah. Get up and rock, get up and move your feet, yeah, yeah, yeah. Cause when the music hits you, yes, you feel no pain. Tell us
see, let's pull up, pull up, pull up, and wheel it up again. We bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah. Some boy I gotta learn, fire I burn, them can't out it out. Some boy never learn, got the wrong turn, I know them fire out. The fire I'm a burn, I like furnace, fool, watch him out. Turn up the heat, I make it knock your heart out, yeah. Now give me no shit, now give me no talk, no. No confrontation, give me a walk, yeah. Now give me no rain, give me the sun, now give me no bomb, now give me no gun, give me the joy, give me the fun, give me the bass and give me some drum, yeah. Cause when the music hit, you feel no pain. Tell the selector, pull up and wheel it up again, yeah, yeah. Give me some grace from my brain, cause the music driving me insane, yeah. The flow so volcanic, them can't stand it, them panic when them violate the order, the lava burn all of them. Tell pagans and Babylon to line up, make them turn. See to the end of the day why fire burn. Yeah, we bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah. Yes, you feel no pain. Tell the selector, pull up, pull up, and wheel it up again. We bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah. We bring fire, my bring the heat. Yo, the way the music's sweet, you have to move your feet, yeah. Get up and rock, get up out of your seat. Get up out of your avenue, get up out of your street, yeah. Yo, cause when the music hits, you feel no pain. Tell the selector, pull up, and wheel it up again, yeah, yeah. Give me some greens for my brain, cause the music's driving me insane. The flow so volcanic, them can't stand it, them panic when them violate the order, the lava burn all of them. Tell pagans and Babylon to line up, with them turn. See to the end of the day why fire burn. Yeah, we bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah. Fire, get up and rock, get up and move your feet, yeah. Music hits you, yes, you feel no pain. Tell the selector, pull up and wheel it up again. We bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah. We bring fire, yeah, we bring the heat, yeah.
Well, it's come to think them call a broken artist. Blessed love will never part, you don't know it from the start, yeah. I tell them, say I'm dirty, yeah. A Sean Paul and Sasha, come sing for them, baby.
What is it about you, baby?
I don't say, don't say, don't say love. Controller girl, and I make your head swirl, and I make your body twirl, and I make you wanna be my one and only baby girl. Night after night, make you feel love to keep you warm. Girl, you never get this kind of loving from your bond. I know you want your cats, and we just can't perform.
I love you, baby.
Oh, yeah. I show you get the little loving I'm
gone. You don't know how to love me.
I ain't know no time for no kissing and
not
charm.
Not even how to kiss.
You must take your little advice, darling.
I don't know why.
Baby girl.
I love you, baby.
I don't see love.
I'm still in love with you, boy.
Well, I'm a hustler and a player, and you know I'm not to say it. That's the dirty love. Understand that a man is just a man. That's the dirty, dirty love.
I'm still in love with you, boy.
The blessed loving from the start, but you know we're at the part. That's the way I give my love.
I'm still in love. Yes, I'm still in love.
Yo, what
with
a man
you
gotta do? What a man gotta do, girl? Hey, I told me give and tug love and say bye, bye, bye. But turn around.
to ask a question, why? When me leave in me city, girl, I cry. And it hurts my heart to tell a lie. So don't cry no more, baby girl, for sure. Just remember the good times we had before.